Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This is part one of the Mark Thomas Experience. Enjoy. Welcome to the Humorology Podcast with me, Paul Barros, and my glittering lineup of guests from the worlds of business, sport, politics, and entertainment, who are here to share their wisdom and their use of humour with you. Humorology is the study of how humour can dramatically improve every aspect of your business and your life. Humorology puts the fun into business fundamentals, increases the value of your laughing stock, and puts a punchline back into your bottom line. Please remember to like, subscribe, and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. My guest on this edition of the Humorology Podcast is an award-winning comedian, journalist, and formerly host of the Mark Thomas Comedy Product on Channel 4, where he was well known for pulling political practical jokes. He revels in combining comedy with political activism. As an alternative comic, he's built a career in the sweet spot between politics, comedy, and investigative journalism. Most recently, he's the author of the brilliantly enlightening and hilarious 50 Things About Us, What We Really Need to Know About Britain, where he takes a closer look at lesser-known facts about our nation. Despite winning the Time Out Comedy Award and being awarded the Kurdish National Congress Medal of Honour, I believe that his most impressive achievement is his Guinness World Record for hosting 20 political protests in under 24 hours. Mark Thomas, welcome to the Humorology Podcast.
Hello, Macy.
What the viewer and the listener doesn't know is we see each other every week or so at the football at AFC Wimbledon.
I rather like that. I like the fact that we have a sort of, not just that we meet every week, but we know where we're going to meet and we know when we're going to meet. And that at halftime, we will always meet under the little flyover and that'll be us. We'll be just by the bar and that a group will gather and we will dissect and discuss the failures, occasionally the successes of the team. I think it's one of my highlights, actually. I love our little meetings and just the way that people congregate around.
It is. I mean, that's really what it is. For people who don't know, that's the community of football whereby, and it's beautiful at AFC Wimbledon because that happens. If only the football could match the beauty of those moments.
Well, do you know, I was doing a gig the other night. It was, in fact, on Saturday night after Wimbledon had lost. And I said, I follow AFC Wimbledon and a whole load of people at the Banana Cabaret, which, you know, has got that balcony at the top. So yeah. you does. All of this was going on. Scared the fuck out of the middle class in the centre. They really wobbled. It was just absolutely brilliant. And it was very funny just talking about, I said, you know, I follow Wimbledon, not for the football, but because I really like singing in public and I'm not religious. So all I've got is the football. And in fact, I think church would be improved if you put in on Sunday highlights from Saturday over the altar during communion, because you get a whole load of football fans in. The singing would just be brilliant.
Well yeah, and just as the priest was about to do the sacrament, you go, whoa,
you're saved. We are Baptists, super Baptists. So you'd get all of that going on.
Oh God. No, I think I think there's a plan there.
My old man said, be a Methodist. I said, fuck off, bastard. Anyway.
I think we found our level.
I got heckled as well on Saturday night by a woman who just very drunkenly went, I'm an RE teacher at a Catholic girls' school. It's just like, that's lovely. That's lovely. Is there anyone else who doesn't have sex?
Oh, what a great comeback. Oh, well, we'll come on to heckles and life on the circuit later on, because I want to start with, you grew up in Southwest London with a midwife mother and a self-employed builder father. What was humour actually valued at home?
Yeah. Really, especially because my dad was quite violent. And genuinely was, he would, there was a stage where we would turn up in court once a year to see him bound over to keep the peace. This is completely true. And we were the family, we were the happy family who were put in the courtroom, do you know what I mean? And my dad, because he was a lay preacher as well as a builder, and also foul-mouthed and physically violent, he got on very well with the... With the bloke next door who was a Salvation Army captain, who loved my dad. He loved my dad. And so this guy who was from Norfolk used to be the character witness. And he'd stand there going, I have known Colin Thomas for many years. Colin is a family man. Colin is a Christian man. Colin is a whole. We're all standing there going, I wish I knew this bloke. He sounds great. So, humour was quite important, because not only was it a way of sort of like, it was a very hierarchical, sort of like paternal, literally my dad was Old Testament, he looked like Moses with syphilis, and he had this incredible sort of physical strength to him. And so when you're intimidated like that, the one thing you've got is humor. That's the one thing you have. And humor always had a special place in our house, because it was the one place where my dad could relax. It was the one thing you could feel safe. So, and this is just true. My dad would come in after work, and he would have there was a whole ritual of putting away the scrap metal and, cutting up wood and all this kind of stuff. And he would have his bath in the morning. My dad always had a bath in the morning, so it was clean for work, which showed his priorities. And all right, love, let's just snuggle up next to the concrete dust. Come on. But, he was... And he had this old pair, he had these favourite leather armchairs. And what he used to do was he'd come in after tea, after he'd sorted out all the woods and the scrap metal and all of that, he'd go into the living room and he'd sit in his favourite leather armchair, but he didn't want to get his dirty builder's trousers on the chair. So he'd drop his trousers around his ankle and sit in the leather armchair in his long johns, right? Laugh, and I always used to go, this is great, because he'd laugh at Stepturn some for being uncouth. And it was just like, it was perfect. And on more than one occasion, because people used to come round, right, to after tea, to ring the doorbell and go, all right, Colin, we've got a bit of a job on for you. So all local people used to turn up and you'd discuss the business on the doorstep. And more than once you'd hear my dad go, oh, but put me fucking trousers on. And so he would go to the door. But that one place, it was that one place. So it was the one place that humour was allowed. And Dave Allen and Stepturn Son were the heroes. They were the absolute heroes. Stepturn Son, my dad, because it was Gorton & Simpson. It was written brilliantly. It reflected some part of his experience. Do you know what I mean? Of working class and making do, a fight. Like, my dad would never throw anything out. He'd never throw, everything was saved. He was an environmentalist before it became fashionable. He used to save everything. My job when I was 8, I used to burn the lead off of brass fittings with a blowtorch and catch it in a ladle. And it was all to prepare everything for the scrapyard. Let me tell you a story. We used to go out the scrapyard, right? And they had a car crush. Everyone knew my dad. It was where, actually, the scrapyard is where that big lovely place in Chelsea is, Chelsea Harbour, that posh.
Oh, yes.
That's where the scrapyard used to be. They used to have a scrap metal crusher, car crusher. And we get there one day and the car crusher's on fire. right? And the bloke running it, standing there with a fag and a cup of tea, and there's a few members of fire brigade. My dad went, bloody hell. He said, yeah, someone left some petrol in the tank. Normally you drain it, but someone must have left it in, and a few sparks, and bang, up it goes. And my dad went, bloody hell. He said, how often does... He said, all you can do is just stand around. Just stand around, have a cup of tea and a fag and wait for it to call the fire brigade. All you've got to do is wait for it to go out. You can't do anything. And my dad said, how often does this happen? He said, every time I've got a hangover. So Steptoe and Son represented a part of my dad's existence. Do you know what I mean? Dave Allen was just a genius.
Did you not write for Dave Allen?
I tried to. I was very bad at it. I was very bad at it. I adored Dave Allen. I thought he was him and Billy Connolly are the nearest we've got. So you see Dave Allen and you see Billy Connolly, right? I was talking to a mate about this. Peter Cook was described by John Cleese as the gatekeeper for the field that we now all play in. I described Alexis Sale as the bloke who booted down the squat so that we could all get in. Yeah. And muck about. In that squat on the wall was a picture of Billy Connolly where Jesus should have been, because we could never be like him. We would never, ever, ever. We could have people like Alexis Sale and Peter Cook and, you know, John Clayton and all those people who could inspire us. But Billy Connolly, Dave Allen, we would never be as good as them. They were genius.
Yeah.
So this was the story I was going to tell you, Paul. What it was the power of a joke. I'm banished from the doorstep when the business meetings are going on, right? After tea, doorbell, bloke comes around. I need you to fix the gutters. How do you think you can da-da-da-da-da? You have a little natter, you have a dance, you do the thing. My dad turns and says, I'll put you in the book, right? That's how it goes. And there's a lot of how's your missus, how's that, did you see so-and-so? It's all that kind of stuff. But kids aren't allowed on the doorstep. That's just, when the business is done, kids aren't allowed on. So we're watching Steptoe and Son, the doorbell goes, it's Jim from like three on the other side. Jim Darby was his name. And he comes over to talk to my dad. And Steptoe and Son is on. And it's at the time that VAT has just been introduced, right? So VAT didn't exist until the early 70s when it came in. And there was a joke on it. And he goes, when's he going to come and visit us? He said, what do you want about? He said, the Prime Minister. What about you? The Prime Minister visiting us? Yeah, VAT, visiting all totters. Now, totters was what scrap metal merchant used to be called. So visiting all totters. My dad used to call himself, I'm a totter. So that's what. So I heard the gag, thought it was hysterical, ran out onto the doorstep. Jim Diver goes, all right, little. And my dad goes, get out of it, you know. And I said, when's he going to visit us? He said, what's you on about? I said, the Prime Minister. My dad goes, what? I said, VAT. And Jim Darby goes, VAT. I said, visiting all totters. And they both laughed. And ooh. Jim Darby said, you got a right one there, Colin. And my dad held my hand, let me stay on the doorstep. Power of a joke.
Oh, man. So that was the seminal moment, was it? Where you suddenly went.
Yeah. Yeah. When you could see it. You know, something hits you inside and you go, that's how powerful this is.
And I mean, but were you therefore then the kid at school who actually thought, I'm going to do this? And well, the class clown classic, you know, branding of.
Sort of I was. I used to be able to impersonate all the other boys really well. And so it kind of saved me from getting clumped every now and again. But also, I wasn't bad at clumping people. So.
Best of both worlds.
Yeah. I always liked proper creative mischief, something that would really cause someone some distress. Do you know what I mean? You want mischief to be. My mate once was at school, they had these study rooms, and my mate once had his nose broken by a bully. And so when he left, we got into his study room, and he had all these posters and everything. We got hold of some really thick, like a brie cheese, like a soft cheese, like primulas and stuff like that. And we smeared it all over the walls and then put the posters back on. right? For the next 6 months, he was just going, what the fuck is it in here? I don't know what it is. I've tried everything. And it is just that kind of like, getcha.
Yeah. So that's the through line in it. Was it? I mean, was there also what I would call a show off gene in there as well? Because I think we all kind of had it in a certain way.
Of course. Look, we are just highly evolved show offs who get paid money for showing off. That's what it basically is. We are the baboons with the brightest arses. That's what it is. Right. And what we do is show off, and we show off in creative ways. And I love that. I love that. I love the fact that, when you do a gig, like I did a gig on Saturday, and the audience were half there, half not. It was 40 minutes. Now, there's loads and loads of political stuff. Some of it they jumped on, some of they didn't. But I really fucking rammed them and got them and all of that. And it was just like a fucking battle. And at the end of it, I walked up to, and there's half a dozen comics and their mates, and they went, that was fucking rock and roll, Mark. And it was like, that's what matters.
Yeah.
Those eight people on the balcony, my peers, that's what matters.
But that was always the way, wasn't it? That we were always much more interested in going back to, the audience should know that we first met in 1985 at the Comedy Store, which is... And it was always more important that your peers liked what you did. And I remember we used to play a lot of the time to Kim Kinney and Stan, who was the sound man. And if they were laughing, the whole audience could be quiet. But if they laughed, you'd kind of won, hadn't you?
Yeah, yeah. And I loved it when you used to be able to get, when they were running gags, when everyone had to try and put a word into the set on the late show or something stupid like that. Comquat. I remember Comquat just appearing. And it, sometimes people couldn't put it in their set. So it would just go, I'm so-and-so Comquat, and then leave. And, it was just, and I think you have to have those little things. So you know, comedy works on all sorts of different levels, and it also represents all sorts of different threats. And it's also, you know, it's as welcoming as it is threatening. It depends who you are. Mm. Do you know what I mean? I'll give you an example of this. When we used to have big Sunday do's, right? So my nan lived with us, so everyone come round. And my dad built this enormous table. Everyone would get round this table. Everyone squeezed up. Sunday lunch. You'd go down the Lord Napier Jazz Pub, lunchtime. Right, all in the builders' vans, bouncing around, and you get a few pints in, listen to the jazz, and you go back, and Sunday lunch would appear, and there'd be all sorts. There'd be uncles and aunts and, you know, cousins, and there'd always be someone you didn't know. There'd be a girlfriend or a boyfriend. Once my Uncle Norman brought back a woman. He said, I met her in the pub. She just didn't have anywhere to go. And I'm like, thanks for bringing her home. So, you know, there's all these people turned up for Sunday lunch. And we're sitting there. I used to have a girlfriend called Jo, who's from Manchester, from Urmston. And she always used to try and kind of make herself kind of access to the family by using London colloquialisms. Do you know what I mean? She used to just to try and get herself more in with the family. And I remember once we were sitting there, my Uncle Norman goes, Jo, do you want to top up with your wine? And she turned around and went, yeah, just a minge. And my Uncle Norman, he thought minge meant a small amount of top up. I mean, I'll just have a minge. And my Uncle Norman just played it straight and went, do you want a minge? Would anyone get Jo a minge, please? Do you want a red minge or a white minge? Do you want a minge? Okay, would someone get Jo a red minge? And played it for about 5 minutes before we all just cracked up and told her what it meant. Anyway, ever since that moment, a minge, as in our house, means a small amount of liquid, right? Yeah. So, and it's kind of like used as a family thing. So when my nephew George brought his girlfriend round once, he goes, Nan, do you want a cup of tea? And she went, just a minge of milk. And it was just, you just have to go. So that's what it means now. So humour becomes this way of inviting you into the gang.
Oh, that's interesting, isn't it? That it is a gang, and how we relate to people is, do you get this?
Do you know it? Here's the initiation ritual. Come and join us.
So how important is that in everyday life? Because I think it's crucial that if you don't actually, and this doesn't, this, we were just doing an interview with Helena Kennedy, the Baroness Helena Kennedy, who's the equal opportunities lawyer. And she was fascinating about this. She came from the south side of Glasgow, tenements, and now she's in the House of Lords. And that humour is still that conduit that allows her into all these spaces, which she's just, and I think that you are allowed in any space because of your playfulness, and you are funny, which is kind of the entry ticket, isn't it?
I think it is. It does let you into places that you wouldn't normally get into. And I mean, it's humour's used all over the place. Do you know what I mean? And it's not just the social interaction. It allows social interactions. It allows us to be self-deprecating and pull back the threat of ourselves. It allows us to give someone who thinks they're better than us a little slap, you know, gently, and just put them in their... There is the shared thing where you share something. You laugh at something that's around you or someone who's near you, and you share something, so you bond together. So humour's really, really important for that. But I think there's a bigger, I mean, it's socially, it's vital. It's absolutely vital. You couldn't exist. You know, was it Chaplin who said a day without laughter is a wasted day? Oh. You know, which is beautiful. It's a beautiful thing. And Orwell actually said each joke is a revolution, a tiny revolution, which I think is kind of like, yeah, but you've obviously never been bullied properly, because each joke isn't a tiny revolution. Each joke is, well, you're either going up or you're going down. You know, you're punching up or you're punching down. You're making someone the target who's worthy of being a target, or you're attacking someone who's not worthy of being a target and bullying. So that's the essence of satire. Why would you go after people who aren't in power? You need to go after people who are in power. That's the whole gig of it. And people in power don't like it.
Well, it's because they can't play at that level, can they? Because it's like, oh, any totalitarian regime, the first thing they do is close down theatre and comedy because they can't control it.
They can't control it. And there's that great quote, I'm bastardising it, but it's, the truth is written on the toilet door. Do you know what I mean? That actually, that's going to be, yeah, that's where you find the last bastion of freedom of speech, is the back of a toilet door. It's also where you find some very interesting people, Paul. there is something to be said for that. And I think the thing that they don't like is taking away respect. You can rule through fear. This is the name of the rose. You can rule through fear, but laughter will undermine fear. Right? Laughter undermines it. And you've only got to look at how many cartoonists are jailed in Turkey, in Saudi Arabia, in Qatar, in Egypt. You know, how many, you know, cartoonists who are shot dead, not just in Paris, but around the world. You know, in Chile, cartoonists were rounded up. You know, these are people in power don't like this feeling that we're all laughing at them. They don't like it because it spreads. And that undermines their authority. It undermines their fear. And who knows, we might actually take them out of power.
Well, and it's also, they can't control it. And yeah. They don't like anything that they can't control. And so at which point, I mean, in South Africa, you know, I had a mate who actually was part of a theatre group, but had to leave in the middle of the night because he got word that they were coming after the theatre group.
Well, it says in Myanmar, the Mustache Brothers are a satirical group, and they were jailed. They were just banged up. You know, they used to appear on demos occasionally, and you could go and see them if you're a tourist. You could go and see the satirical show, but they'd be banged up if they performed it in public. So let the tourists see it, but don't let the populace at it. You know, this still goes on. It went on during... you know, Britain actually had the censorship laws, you know, up until the late 50s, I think it was, where everything had to go through the Lord Chancellor, and you had a blue pencil. right? And so radio sketches, telly sketches, anything that a double act had to go through the Lord Chancellor, songs had to go through the Lord Chancellor, you know, and so you ended up with people who would have, there'd be blue pencil marks through the things you couldn't say. And in fact, one comic used to use the word blue pencil instead of swearing. I was walking down the Blue Pencil Road the other day, and this right blue pencil comes up. So EVV, and it was like a way of undermining the censorship as well as acknowledging it. So you get people like, you'd also you get lewdness. People were accused of lewdness. Harry Champion was taken to court. Harry Champion did Boiled Beef and Carrots and Any Old Iron, and was taken to court for singing lewd songs. And in court, he stood up and said, "Your Honor, I ain't paid to step upon the musical stage and sing hymns." It's just such a lovely thing. People in authority want you to keep the authority. They want to keep the respect. So actually, humor undermines it, and it's brilliant. That's what it's fantastic at.
Well, I think you're quite right, and you've used it as kind of a battering ram to actually find the truth, haven't you, a lot of the time?
Well, I think it's not just find the truth. You want to, I mean, it's changing things. You want to change things. We did a thing. I'll tell you, can I tell you a very quick story? It's an old routine, right? And this actually happened. There's a law called the Conditionally Exempt Works of Art List, where if you inherit works of art, you put them on a list and you don't get to pay tax, right? It applies to land and buildings and all of this. The thing was, you couldn't find out what works of art were there, who had them, where they were, how you could see them. So you had a theoretical right to see them. We allowed you not to pay tax, but you had to let the public in. But the public weren't allowed to know where it was or who had it or how to get there, right? So we did a campaign. We found out some of the people who'd got, we found out a few bits and pieces about people on the list. One of them was Nicholas Soames. Nicholas Soames was ex-Armed Forces Minister and good friends of Charles Windsor, and was once described by a girlfriend, who's a very large man, he's once described by a former girlfriend in private eye. She said, making love with Nicholas Soames was like having a large cupboard fall on you with the key sticking out. Now, he had a lovely three-tier mahogany, partly reeded, slender, baluster upright mahogany coffee table, of which I'm incredibly fond. And he hadn't paid tax on it. So we had a right to visit it. So I wrote saying, can I come and see your three-tier mahogany coffee table, partially really slender baluster upright supports? He said, yes, you can. Make an appointment. So we made an appointment. A couple of days before, I said, I got in contact and said, look, some mates of mine have heard about the three-tier mahogany buffet table with partially really slender baluster upright supports. We were talking about it in the pub. It's very popular. They'd like to come along. You wouldn't believe how popular it is. And he said, well, they can't. I said, well, they've got a right to see it. He said, yes, if they wish to see it, they should make individual applications. So we got about 300 people to make individual applications to see the three-tier mahogany coffee table with partially really slender baluster upright supports. He goes nuts, puts it in Christie's auction house over 2 weeks, and people can go in, right? And so we arrived to see it, and we were encouraging people, just getting loads of people, come and see it, come and see it. And we dressed up as works of art. So my mate came as the Mona Lisa, another friend of mine came as a Salvador Dali painting, so they had a clock falling out of them. My mate Paul came as Robert Mapplethorpe in a bold move in chaps and a leather thong. And so we're queuing up, and they said, you can't film, you can't take photographs, because they were frightened we'd put it on the telly show and it'd get more people on. I said, you can't film, no photography. So we had bought every other method of recording an image. We had got clay modellers, we got pipe modellers, we had got courtroom artists, we'd got sketchers, we had got etch-a-sketchers, we had got everything. We had got people with very good memories who were going at 6'3" long, and you know, it was all of it. So anyway, we encourage people to go and see it. And a little bit later, mates of mine phoned up and said, look, we've tried to get to see the three-tier mahogany coffee table, but he's not replying to us. I thought, well, that's not the game. That's not how it works. So I phoned up the Inland Revenue and dobbed him in and said, look, I wish to report a crime. And they said, well, he might not show you the coffee table for several reasons. I said, what reasons? I said, well, we can't tell you his tax affairs. I said, well, no, but what are the reasons? He said, well, one is he might not show you it because he had it destroyed. And I said, I have heard of no such tragedy befalling the House of Soames. He said, neither have I. He said, the other reason is someone might have stolen it. I said, I've heard of no such act of vandalism. He said, neither have I. He said, the third and final reason is someone might not let you see it because they've paid the tax. I said, has he? He said, I can't possibly disclose personal tax information. However, that is the third and final reason. So years pass by. And I see, I'm visiting an MP in Portcullis House. I'm walking past the atrium where they've got all the coffee shops and all the like MPs and secretaries and lobbyists are all sitting around. And I see Nicholas Soames and I rush over and just sit in front of him very rudely and go, Nicholas Soames, do you remember me? Mark Thomas, Channel 4. He goes, yes. I said, you've got a three-tier mahogany buffet table, partially really slender baluster upright supports. Yes. I said, I hope you're looking after it. He said, yes. I said, did you take it off the list? Said, yes. I said, did you pay tax? Said, yes. I said, fucking gotcha. Gotcha. And we changed the law on that. We mentioned in the House of Commons of changing the law, tightening up the loopholes, you know, and it's that's really exciting that you can use it like that, that you can use comedy like that. That, you know, I've ended up giving evidence before the select committees on three occasions, right? Once was before privileges, the privilege committee that were looking at public office, people in public bodies. And there's quite strict rules on public bodies about what you should declare. And we found loads and loads of cases of people who hadn't declared things. So what we did, we got Howard Marks, the convicted drug smuggler, and Joe Guest, who is a female model. And Joe Guest turned up. She was great. She turned up. She goes, I've got the kit on if you want me to wear it. And no, we're all right. We're all right. And we got Howard Marks and Joe Guest to phone up all these people going, you've made mistakes on your entries over your public bodies and the requirements. We'd like you to apologize for it. So we were getting, you know, glamour models and drug dealers to phone up and have a go at them. The funniest moment, I thought, Joe Guest arrives with all this stuff and the production manager goes, bloody hell, because she's got these enormous pair of stilettos, like Perspex stilettos. And Catherine says, how do you walk in those? And she went, I don't. So you can use humour in all sorts of ways. Joe Guest used it to deflect what she does and to get an upper hand in a situation. You know, we were using it to deflate the great and the good by getting nefarious ne'er-do-wells to expose them. We then got the mob joining in to go and see rich people's, you know, works of art that they were supposed to let us see. All this stuff is humour. All of this stuff is about challenging people. We used to set up front arms companies and just say, look, we'd like to, and you know, we'd get in touch with people and just say, I'm an arms dealer, I want to buy some weapons. And they would tell you what they'd sell, and they'd give you the grey areas. And the grey areas are the interesting bits, because that's the bit where you can catch them, dob them in, and lobby the government to change the law.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So do you, well, I think you obviously do, but the old adage about the truth goes down easier with a joke attached. Can you actually get to the nub of the problem with a joke attached easier?
I really think you can. I think it was, you know, so it's one of these things you know, it's this idea about can you laugh about anything? And the answer is yes and no. It depends who's laughing. It depends who's laughing at. And it depends whose experience you're mocking. You know, can you laugh at child abuse? No. Can you mock Gary Glitter? Yes. Do you know what I mean? That's the difference. Yeah. And I think it's a really important difference. Should we laugh at Prince Andrew? Yeah. Yeah, we should. Because, you know, that's what's pushed him into the back room somewhere. You know, the threat of people just, someone shouting out he's a nonce at a funeral procession. You know, that's amazing.
Yeah.
People would say, you know, well, that's disrespectful. Maybe, but actually bringing him along is disrespectful, to be honest.
Yeah, but it's that thing whereby you are able to prick the bubble of pomposity.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Can I tell you just a couple of quick stories? We were after the Export Credit Guarantee Department. What they do is they bankroll medium to high risk exports. Okay. So if you're selling weapons to a dictator, you can get the government to provide underwriting, to provide insurance. So the bank will lend the dictator the money to buy your guns, and the government provide the insurance to the bank in case the dictator doesn't pay. This meant the UK government underwrote arms sales to Saddam Hussein in Iraq. The banks lent Saddam Hussein the money. Saddam Hussein bought the guns. Then he stopped paying the repayments. The government paid the banks. The banks paid the people with the guns. So everyone was square apart from Saddam Hussein and the British taxpayer. So we literally paid for the bullets that were fired at British troops. God. We literally paid for them. Oh. And we went after this department quite a lot. And we had people who would leak stuff to us. And we exposed corruption there. We exposed wrongdoing. At one point, we chased a civil servant who was, because we used to bushwhack people, just come up with the most inventive bushwhacking techniques. Once we just followed a bloke. He was going to a formal dinner at the Guildhall, and we just followed him in from the street. We saw where he was coming out, and we followed him in from the street, firing questions at him. And then the doormen were there, and we just walked in after them. And because we were wearing dinner jackets, and so was the camera crew, they just let us in. So we followed him in. I ended up in the bog with the senior civil servant asking him questions about arms deals, right? And we couldn't use that footage. But, you know, that was where we were going with it. And we would bushwhack them all the time. The great moment for us, the moment, it wasn't just the fact that we got them, the fact that we exposed, we had front page exposés, do you know what I mean, in The Guardian. A minister actually asked civil servants, and this, I know this is self-aggrandizing, but he said, I've actually got it somewhere. We got all the stuff on data protection. It's got, the minister wants us to dig for dirt on Thomas so he can rubbish him.
Ooh.
Right? Literally, we have that. Because we were going after this department. Anyway, some people I know who are trade unionists went in for a meeting with these senior civil servants. And it was at one of these towers near Canary Wharf. And they had the top floor. And they were all there on the top floor with all the windows looking out over the city. And they were about to talk about terms and conditions with the senior management. And they heard this noise. And they looked round, and it was the cradle used for window cleaners, you know, from the top that would go down the side of the buildings. And they turned round, and all the civil servants were under the table going, get under the table, it's Mark Thomas, get under the table.
but they were really worried by you. I mean, genuinely, yeah. Weren't they? Because I love the fact that you actually got access to the police records at one stage, and you were described in an official police document as a general rabble rouser. And I love this bit, alleged comedian.
I am putting that on a poster. Alleged comedian, The Met. Comedy Review, The Met. I love it. I mean, there's stuff. I'll find you one of my favourite ones was. Can I give this after? Because I've got the book. Should I give you a copy of this? Let me have a look.
Yes, I've got copies of the book. Which one? 100 Acts.
Yeah. So we've got 100 Acts. Here we go. So
there you go. Look, two 100 people acts doing the same thing.
And it was where we did. I mean, basically, they had to hand over you because under data protection, you write in and you say, I want all the information you've got on me. And everyone can do this on a public body. The police originally were able to avoid it because it was part of it was run the unit that gathered information. I was called a domestic extremist. The unit that gathered information worked out of ACPO, which is the Association of Chief Police Officers, which I don't know whether you know this, but it's a private company. So ACPO didn't apply. The data protection, they would argue, didn't apply to them. So when all the spying stuff blew up, the police had to admit, had to take it in hand, and that's when you could get your information. This is one of my favourite ones. 2402, 2007. Stop the war march, Trafalgar Square. About 1408 hours, the most useless use of the word about. About 1408 hours, we spotted Mark Thomas, who is a comedian. Thomas was on a silver mountain bike with yellow forks, an orange bib with protester written on the back of it and a white cycle helmet. He said hello to us as he passed and seemed very happy. I mean, you know, that's on my official file. That's on my police file. What have we got here? We've got all sorts here.
How scary is it that there are official police files of a comedian?
Here it is. It's got, this is another one. This was from, we had a demonstration on May Day and we did a thing. I wasn't the organizer of it. I just went along. People called for guerrilla gardening. You would go to Parliament Square and plant fruit and vegetables. Right, to plant a garden in the devil's patio. And this is what it says on that day. 1st of May, 2000. Event, Parliament Square. Mark Thomas, brackets, TV presenter and activist, stops to stand in the way of the camera. Has quantity of cress on the rear of his cycle.
You crazy guy.
Cress. As I said, the ISIS of Garnish. Cress. But I mean, what I think is interesting about that is actually, I mean, I laugh at it, but I mean, there is an element, the laughing is coping with it because, you know, I've had four court cases with the police, right? Two of which I've won, two of which are ongoing, one of which they're about to settle. Mates of mine were spied upon. That once you appear on one list, you start to appear on other lists. And this isn't me, you know, this is just true. I appeared on the construction blacklist, right, which was a blacklist that stopped workers. If you try to organise on, you know, and this is well documented, if you try to organise unions or you complained about health and safety, you could be put on a blacklist. And there are people who were in the middle of a building boom, didn't work for decades, you know, and this is dreadful. And I appeared on that blacklist. It was a raid by the information commissioner on this bloke's house who ran the blacklist. And it was funded by all the major building companies, you know, Skanska, Balfour Beatty, McAlpine, Taylor Woodrow, all of that lot funded it. Now, you might say, oh, Mark, this is just, you know, this is self-aggrandizement and fantasy. Well, it's not, because my name appeared on the list and I was one of the least important court cases that came up with that. And I got 10 grand's worth of compensation from McAlpine, Skanska, Balfour Beatty, Taylor Woodrow for being on their lists. Right. Other people got, rightly so, you know, more money for being, you know, they admitted it in court. And actually, the thing about this is, you do have to have, you know, to be able to go, oh, well, people have stolen my litter bins, stolen my bins so that they could go through it and try and find stuff. You have to have a little bit of a sense of humour about that.
Well, yeah, but it's a coping mechanism at that point, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. But that's it. But also, it's not just a coping mechanism. It's a way of reclaiming something. Right. Ah. In a way that, you know, the word queer used to be used as a pejorative word. And actually, the LGBTQ plus community have claimed that and start to use queer. Not everyone does, but a significant group of people who use the word queer as theirs. It's our word. We take this thing away from it. It's like the N word and rappers. Do you know what I mean? I don't have a problem with not being able to use the N word. Right. I don't have a problem with that. And I don't have a problem with people who are people of color being able to use it. It's a way of claiming it, if you like. And so I think when you do this stuff, it's a way, you know, we had T-shirts and tea towels with domestic extremists printed up on it. Right. My mate made me a cup and saucer, a domestic extremist, and it had a cupcake with a fuse coming out of it, you know, and it's a way of claiming it and going, this is, you use this against us, but we will take it and we will run with it because we're not frightened. We're not afraid.
So therefore, the humour aids resilience in that sense.
Oh, yeah. Of course, humour is ultimately about resilience. Anyone who's got a shit job will tell you that. Do you know what I mean? Anyone would tell you that. One of my favourite... I used to work on the building site. I know someone who dropped a scaffold pole off the roof through the roof of a convertible Mercedes. Walked off the job. He just walked off the job. Didn't bother to say sorry. Didn't bother to collect his money. Just fucked off. That was it. Fucked. Absolutely fucked. But from that point in, he was known as Vlad the Impaler. Oh. And I love that. I love that, you know, that people have that sense of, you know, I think the tea room is one. This is what it's really interesting. Tea rooms are where you used to be able to meet and talk shit and fuck about and, you know, just create bonds with each other. And actually, that's one of the things, you know, about Zura contracts and all of that kind of stuff is that you don't have tea rooms, you don't have fixed term contract, but people always meet up because you have to. People always, you look at Deliveroo, there's always a spot where the riders meet. There's always a spot, and that's their tea room, if you like. That's the place where they meet and they swap stories and they take advice and they say, don't do this one, do this one. And that's where they form bonds that then go on to form a trade union.
That's really interesting. I want to go back to you worked with your dad, Colin, on building sites, as you said, prior to working at the Comedy Store. Was that good grounding for what was effectively a tough school at the Comedy Store and the Tunnel and all those clubs?
Well, I mean, I should say I went to drama school as well. You know, I didn't just go. I went to drama school. It's a Bretton Hall College. And I was my dad was brutal. Right. He literally. He was very pleased that I was the first person in our family to go to university. Gutted it was drama school. And I came back after the first term and he goes, so what did you get up to? And I described, you know, dance movement classes and then, you know, how we do improvisation and then we do study of classical text and modern playwrights and then we go on and do people's assessment plays. And my dad's only comment was, these dance classes, they make you wear tights. It was just like, you know, I don't understand this. And so he tried somehow to connect. I remember once we went to see, when I got a place to drama school, he was like, yeah, well done. And we went to see The Importance of Being Earnest at the Old Vic. And it was a proper, like, son and father bonding thing. You know, we went there and it was fantastic production. It was really fun. It's a great play. After about 10 minutes, do you know what I mean? So, there were no prisoners with him. It was just kind of like you just got done in. That was it. And especially on the building site, because, you know, if any of the lads were working around us, they were like, oh, you got your boy with you. And I was, you know, I wasn't really interested in working there, to be honest. You know what I mean? It was a way of earning money. I'd always done it. I started working. People sometimes say to me, when did your political awareness grow? And I used to load skips for 10p an hour when I was 8. So I used to take buckets of rubble and chuck them on the thing. And this bloke came up to me and goes, how much are you paying you? I said, 10p an hour. Anyway, that's child exploitation. That's slave labour. Colin, this is slave labour. And this my dad goes, fuck off out of it. Fuck off out of it. And I was like, hello.
But this, you've had this extraordinary background with, you know, one part building site, one part Bretton Hall theatre arts degree. I mean, how does that coalesce into sort of the Mark Thomas? Because you've been doing it for a long time now, you know, and it's a very ephemeral thing, comedy, but you've managed to stay relevant. How does that happen?
38 years. I mean, I've always, comedy has always, stand up, I've always loved, but it's always been, you know, it's stories. I've always said stand up is stories. People have got to understand that. A joke has a rule of three. That's why it's a story, a beginning, a middle, and the wrong ending. That's how it works. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? So that's your rule of three. So stand up is a story, just a really small story. What I love are those stories that the great thing about theatre is it's an empathy machine.
Oh.
Right? It allows you to see something from someone else's perspective. It allows you to experience an emotion. And I love stand-up. I adore it. But the ones that I love are the ones where they let you in a little bit into something more. Like Steve Wright. Do you remember the great Steve Wright, the American comic?
Yes, a very... deadpan American comic. Our listeners, look him up. He's, you know.
He used to stand and go, some people are afraid of heights. I'm scared of widths.
Exactly.
And he just had this incredible, I put instant coffee in the microwave. Went back in time. It was just this beautiful, beautiful delivery. And just gag after gag after gag after gag after gag. And after 40 minutes, you're like, oh, show me something of yourself. Do you know what I mean? You just wanted to see some flaws, something.
So is that where the theatricality, because, I mean, shows, you do shows now as well as stand-up, Cuckooed is a brilliant show. It's a disturbing story, but you make it very, very funny. You know, The Red Shed is a story, and you kind of are acting it out. But I suppose that goes back to, I think the best comedians are storytellers. We talked about Connolly, you know, it's come along with me on a story. Let me change your state.
You're absolutely right. Comedy is always about change. Always. And people, no, it's always about change. You start not laughing, you end laughing. There's your fucking building block of change right there. That's the change. So it's always been about change, and it's always been about it's about feeling something, experiencing something. You go in and you feel something, and you feel different when you come out. you might feel emboldened, you might feel alive, you might feel more vital, you know, all these things. That very basic thing is about change. For me, it's about going, okay, can we get people to feel things? Can we get people to experience something which they might not have experienced, to see it from a different angle? And I love that. I adore them. There's something beautiful about it. And it's also a shared thing. It's about sharing. Right.
It is about sharing, yeah. But I was just going to interject there, because you hit on something that really resonated with me, which was in psychology, there's a saying that if you want anyone to go into any state, you have to go into that state first. And I think a lot of the real skill is about embodying that state first and then getting people to come along with you on that story or that journey as well.
I think you're absolutely right. You know, Robin Williams was a fine example of that. You know, if you ever saw him live, which I did,
and I also worked with him at the store. When I say worked,
I mean he is an amazing performer. I mean, absolutely transformed stand-up.
Yeah.
You know, and I always loved Alexis Sayles said, he said, I once worked with Robin Williams. I was introducing him in the store, and, you know, it was at the end of the show, you know, I said, all right, go on and do 10 minutes. He did half an hour. He did half an hour. And then he came off, pinned me up against the wall and did the other half hour.
Well, I have to say that he used to come to the store and come into the dressing room. He was very polite, even when he was coked out of his head. He was very polite. And he goes, do you mind if I just come on and do a lit? And I remember me and Ames going, no, of course, yeah, go on and everything. And he went on and did this 10, which lasted 40. And we had to follow it. Oh. And by then he had sucked every bit of laughter out of that room.
It was, I know, those, Charles Fleischer was another one who did it, who was the voice of Roger Rabbit. Go on and do a tight 10, 40 minutes later. And so basically the audience have had a first half that's an hour and a half, and it is now, the interval is turning up at 1:30. So you're back on stage at 2, and the last act is on at 2:30 in the morning on a Friday. Do you know what I mean?
And so they'd all been on the piss,
alcohol, you know, just like worn out alcohol. And it was those were the sort of like initiations of fire. If you could get through those gigs, you're all right.
Well, that's why, you know, I think there is still that sort of bonding from all of us who started at that era, because
you're absolutely right.
It's war stories as well, isn't it? As well, you know, I mean, we had the lovely Joe Brand on, and, you know, Joe's war stories about it, because it was harder for her as really the only woman who could take them on in the Late Show in the early days.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, she was remarkable with Joe. And I loved her. I loved gigging with her in the early days. She was brilliant. I think this, I wanted to just go on to this. It is war stories, but it's more than that. It's kind of like we've all seen each other without our dignity. Having had it stripped away from us. We have seen each other in triumph and in utter, utter humiliation. Bob Boynton always used to say, if you've died your worst death, which is really horrible, really horrible, and you've gone home and felt like topping yourself, and the next day you think, no, I'll give it another go. He said, you might be a comic. You know, and there is that kind of like, there's a shared experience. I wanted to mention one thing, though, about audience, which is we laugh more as an audience. We share. We share, because laughter is about sharing. And a very simple thing, if you've ever seen The Big Sleep, right? Humphrey Bogart, Lauren Bacall, amazing film, right? Raymond Chandler, original novel, bit of a mind to get through and go, oh, what was the plot by the end of it? But if you've ever seen it at home, it's a good film. If you've ever seen it in a cinema that's packed, it's funny, man. It's really, really funny. The sharp dialogue between Lauren Bacall and between Humphrey Bogart is funny and it's full of sexual tension, because they couldn't have sexual tension. You had to have it in dialogue, you know, yeah. in that rapid fire. Same as Cary Grant, you know, bringing up Baby, you know, with Katharine Hepburn. She's just remarkable. Do you know what I mean? It's just, it's beautiful. It's beautiful stuff. If you watch Jackie Chan movies, early Jackie Chan movies, go and see the stuff he made in Hong Kong. Jackie Chan is basically Kung Fu's Buster Keaton. That's what he is, right? He is one of the most remarkable and funniest performers you will ever, ever see. Him and San Hung, who he often worked with in the early days, the most remarkable. San Hung was quite a big guy. They both trained in the Chinese state. I've forgotten, there's a state performing school where it might be in the opera, where you learn tumbling and clowning and kung fu and all this kind of stuff, dance. And in fact, Michelle Yeoh went there as well, if I remember correct. She trained as a dancer, Michelle Yeoh, before getting into martial arts. What's fascinating about someone like Jackie Chan is, and you can see the tips and the winks all over the place. There's a film called Project A, in which he is, there's a scene, it doesn't matter, there's a scene where he's hanging off a clock tower in the most remarkable homage to Harold Lloyd ever. It's full of it. It's just full of it all the time. In one film, there's a film called the Police Story, which I saw at the Prince Charles Theatre. And it was a Hong Kong film that Jackie Chan directed. It's very funny. There's a scene where he answers telephones in an office. And of course, they're all corded because it was done in the early 80s. And he's flipping it with his feet and catching it, and he's covered in cords. And it's like this monumental bit of clowning that you would expect to find in a Charlie Chaplin film. There's one scene, there's one bit, though, which I think is really telling, which is he does a stunt, and it's kind of replicated in later films, but never as well. He's at the top floor of a shopping mall, and he runs and jumps and grabs hold of the lights, the big column of lights that go down, and he falls down it and they pop as he goes. And he goes down it and bang, he lands on the ground. And it's such a good stunt, they show it three times in the film. They cut away and show it again. They cut away and show it again. And they do that because they know the audience think it's a great stunt and want to see it again. But also they know that it's in a cinema and it's going to be packed. And when I saw it in the cinema, everyone was just like, wow. And the place was alive. It was electric. People were clapping and cheering and laughing. And just, it was, and Jackie Chan made those films knowing they were going to be seen in a cinema, knowing that people were going to be cheering and laughing and mucking about. That's a wonderful thing.
Well, that takes us back to going to football, doesn't it? It's shared experience. Yeah. And a really good comedy crowd, a really good theatre crowd, a really good football crowd. It's that shared experience. You know, we go and see AFC despite the fact that we come away disappointed more times than we do it. But it's funny, and it's a bonding experience with those around us anyway.
I mean, I also go to try and get a linesman to give up their job. I told you the other week, that linesman at the Sutton game, he did a really crap decision. Everyone's shouting and screaming. Anyway, the play continues. He starts running up the pitch. He goes past my mate who goes, "Don't let the defaults get you. You've got this, Lino." And it was this perfect heckle, the perfect heckle. It was just great.
Oh God, no, we love it. We won't go into the song that was sung about him for the rest of the match.
No, don't do that. But I mean, but the point being is, if you look at what laughter does, it brings us together and it challenges people in power.
That was part one of the Mark Thomas Experience. Part two will be coming soon. The Humorology podcast was hosted by Paul Barros, produced by David Rose, music by Steve Hayworth, creative direction by Les Hughes, and additional research by Helen Sykes. Please remember to subscribe, like, and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. This has been a Big Sky production.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.